BBC World Service, welcome to part two of Pity the Poor Soccer Stars, a series about African footballers who've gone from rags to riches and back to rags. I'm Farai Mungazi, and this week I'm in South Africa, and you join me at football training. The Zambian squad camped up here in Johannesburg, being put through their paces as they seek to consolidate their ranking as the top dogs of African football.
When you play, you feel that you're on top of the world, and also you're well rewarded. But it's a question of discipline, because you spend most of the time in a team as a professional, and then afterwards what you do between when you're with the team and the time that you report the following day, I think that is critical.
Watching the training session is the legendary Kalusha Bwalya, the 1988 African Footballer of the Year, reminding me of the kind of problems we heard about in last week's program, how so many African players have risen from abject poverty to earn big money and then lost it all again.
I always try to tell them that you have to keep money aside instead of buying cars or buying clothes or buying things that are not necessary, because a footballer has to earn his living in 10 years so that he can be able to live another 70 years.
There seems to be a significant number of African stars who fall victim to extravagant lifestyles, lack of professional advice and other difficulties, and so end up in penury, despite having earned millions. Today's program is all about what can be done to stop this happening in future. And although we are talking about footballers, the story between the lines is actually Africa itself, its society, attitudes and culture. The African player, lucky enough to get a contract overseas, soon learns how different these can be, as Kalusha found out back in his own playing days.
I think there's a difference. We have in our blood sometimes to be a bit of a showman as Africans, which you can't take away from us. Sometimes as Africans, it's difficult for us to assimilate where we are. In Europe, I think that most of the time you're living in two worlds. Everything that you do there, you're always thinking, hey, if my people can see me now. And I think that is probably not the good attitude.
In sport, of course, attitude is everything. And football's only too aware that wild living and excess can have its impact on team performance. Watching the squad's training with an eagle eye is their French coach Hervé Renard, architect of Zambia's 2012 Africa Cup of Nations victory and a cast-iron disciplinarian.
Some players don't respect too much the discipline outside. I repeat to them all the time, if you don't want to respect the rules, it's not necessary to come. I don't need you. You can be a very good player if you don't want to miss a behavior. Don't come, please.
Is there a connection between the way a player performs on the pitch with his behavior off it?
Yeah, I think you know, in one squad, when one player or two players don't respect the rules, everybody knows they didn't respect the rules. Because it's not possible to be all the time at the high level if you don't have a discipline in your life.
These players then are lucky, not only to be playing for their national team, but to be led by a coach who takes a keen interest in how they live their lives as individuals. It's enlightened self-interest, of course, but it could end up saving some of them from ruin, if only every coach was like Hervé. Of course, in the old days, the risk of players going bankrupt didn't really exist, because they were all poor all of the time.
We were playing for passion more than money, unlike today.
Deep in the bowels of Johannesburg's iconic soccer stadium, I caught up with Stanley Shabalala, or Screamer, to use the name by which most South Africans know him, one of the continent's most distinguished former players.
Because in those days, we were getting monies just after the game, say something like 100 rand, depending on the crowd, of course. But we were more than happy, because in those days, we were more passionate about the game, unlike today.
Screamer paraded his skills during the apartheid era, when South African football was played mainly by impoverished young black men from the townships. There were few super rich players then, but in some ways, says Screamer, his generation were better off.
I've never dreamt of such monies. I didn't know that the players would get this much in this generation. It's good to see players being rewarded, but then it's another thing to see players playing around with money.
Would you like to see the money in football reduced?
No, I wouldn't say I would like to see the money being reduced, but it's just that I would like somebody that can teach the players what to do with the money.
Some kind of schooling then is perhaps the single best bet for rescuing future players from overspending and eventual ruin. The problem is that in Africa, football and education can be mutually exclusive. Across the continent, this is a game that you can play anywhere, even on the roughest bit of ground and with minimal equipment. It's become the game of choice for Africa's poorest children, kids who can be all too easily seduced by money, and the young township boy good enough to go professional is often soon kissing goodbye to lessons. As South Africa's 2010 World Cup chief Danny Jordaan explained to me when I met him at Football House, the headquarters of the South African FA, too many young players have nothing to fall back on after football or if football goes wrong for them.
When you make it as a football star, education becomes irrelevant. And I think that is where the intervention must be, that football is not an alternative to education. You must have the skills and the education to manage the millions. You must be able to count. You must be able to understand the investment market and how to secure a long-term sustainable lifestyle beyond your football career. And I think those issues all come about as a result of very good and sound education.
Now, when we talk about intensity, the level of intensity goes high. Could they do that exercise for 30 minutes where they were chasing each other?
No.
On the floor below Danny's office at Football House, ex-players learn to be coaches, the traditional way out of retirement penury. But there are very few jobs for coaches relative to the number of former players, so this won't help everyone. And since all players have to retire from kicking the ball at a young age, they need other skills outside the game if they are to guard against financial disaster. To find out about one way this can be done, I want to meet the head of the South African Players Union, one of the few active football unions in Africa. Simba Marumo is a former player himself, but I didn't pitch up at a training session or anywhere near a football ground. Hey, hi Simba.
Hi, Farai.
Yeah, thanks for granting me the time to come and see you here.
You're welcome.
I must say that it's not usual for me to come and meet a footballer at a factory.
Yeah, I've played football all my life. And while I was playing, I actually opened a factory, which is where we are right now. And yeah, now I make my living out of these kinds of initiatives.
Shall we go in and have a look?
Absolutely, let's do that.
Simba is now a businessman, in addition to his union activities. So he's got a fail-safe income. So here we are. This is part of the factory. What exactly happens here?
Well, we print t-shirts, we print folders, we print golf shirts, we print, you know, all kinds of garments.
Simba, I think the unique thing is that for most footballers, they start thinking of a project of this nature after their career. But for you, you set it up whilst you were still playing, which implies that you were aware that football was going to come to an end one day. And that appears to be a problem for some players, that they don't appreciate that football is a short career.
Indeed it is, you know, it's very, very short. It doesn't even feel like I even played football. That's how quick it went, you know. In my career, I had a lot of injuries, and I think those were a huge setback at the time. But in hindsight, they were actually a blessing. I remember one time sitting with a broken leg. I hadn't gone to training or gone anywhere for the whole month, you know. At the end of the month, my salary comes in. And at the end of the following month, again, my salary comes in. And I realized, what would have happened had these guys decided they're not going to pay me? What would happen if this injury doesn't heal? I think that was a big eye-opener for me that, you know what, this career is so fragile that I have to have another plan.
The factory employs a few people and has potential to make jobs for several more. Simba wants at least some of them to be ex-players who've fallen on hard times. But he and the union have a much more radical assistance plan too. They're consulting right now on a proposal to add a small extra charge to ticket prices. The idea is to build a retirement fund that will one day ensure all players have something to fall back on. It could be just what's needed, but it could also prove highly controversial.
There are 5 million tickets that are sold every season. So we want to have a 3 rand retirement levy charged in those tickets, which will raise about 50 million rands a season. And we'll save that money for one generation of players of 15 years. And in that 15 years, we'll be able to raise 225 million so that players who start today to start playing their football, in 15 years' time when they retire, there's 225 million rands towards their retirement.
I just wonder how much sympathy you'll find, given that the majority of players earn in 1 year what ordinary South Africans would never earn in a lifetime.
That's one of the perceptions that people have. But the salaries that are publicized are maybe 10% of the guys. You find that most of our young players get locked into long-term contracts that are paying you peanuts. We cannot have the same salaries that the Europeans have. We don't have the kinds of economies. And that's why I like the model of India, which is also a developing country. Go to India. The ICB has a program like that. Guys who played for so many Test cricket matches are entitled to a stipend for life. They dignify their heroes. And we need to implement a similar approach to Africa.
Simba, you know as much as I do that football fans generally all over the world don't like paying an extra cent to go and watch football, no matter how in love they are with the club. Whenever the ticket prices are raised, they'll object.
Yeah, I don't expect it to be an easy decision to come to, but I think it's something that we're going to need to debate, talk about, and get to a conclusion. The ticket price went up last season from 20 rands to 40 rands overnight. Surely, we can add another 3 rands towards the player's retirement.
The South African initiative is still out for consultation, but it's likely to meet resistance not only from fans but the clubs, who won't want to take the blame for rising gate charges. Expect a robust debate before anything comes to pass. In the meantime, what about forcing the players themselves to act? It's something that the former player John Moshwe, also known as Shoes, thinks could work.
We have to do something about it, and there's got to be a policy that says the 20% of your earnings, we're going to invest them.
Are you advocating a situation where clubs actually confiscate some of the money, so to speak, from the players and invest them on their behalf, whether or not they like it?
Yeah, and even educate them in that regard. I mean, they should be aware that this money is being invested. It's your money. But the teams should have a policy that says that 20% of your earnings should be invested for you for future purposes.
Saving his wages seems to have worked for Shoes. Well-dressed, he sped up from our meeting in a top-of-the-range car. But whether football clubs will find the time or inclination to force their teams into saving is uncertain. Many players would resent it. And even some who support it in principle, like Danny Jordan, remain unconvinced.
I think it's a correct thing to do, but I don't think you can achieve it by legislation or enforcement. It's going to be very difficult if an individual who's earning money to impose, even to his benefit. And one of the things that we don't have on the African continent, we don't have organized players' unions. And because players' unions are not well developed, you don't even have an organization that can organize the life and future of the players and get the players to contribute. You don't have that on the continent.
So it seems as if some of the best potential solutions to footballers' poverty are bound to upset one interest group or another, either the clubs, the fans, or even some of the players themselves. But there's one way forward that could have much faster effects. And to find out about it, I went once again beyond the football pitch.
Coming to you live from Johannesburg, it's the Powerball Draw with your host, Fezile Makanya.
South Africa's National Lottery created nearly 100 millionaires in its first year of operation alone. So the operating company Gidani is used to getting ordinary people acquainted with sudden massive wealth.
8.1 million rand.
They actually do become shocked.
they even lose the sense of counting sometimes.
Spokeswoman Tembi Tulwana.
If somebody has won $1 million, they think they won $10,000. Until you actually say, no, it is not. You have to multiply it more than once or twice or 10 times to know what you have earned.
Sounds familiar? Well, if you heard our first program, you'll also recognize what Tembi goes on to say about the family obligations piled onto lottery winners.
The biggest problem then are the relatives. As soon as your sister pitches up, your sister knows better than you, the winner, what they're going to do with the money.
It would appear to me that from what you're saying that, you know, the winnings, you know, whether it's $1 million or $10 million, it becomes a burden, does it?
A nice burden. But a burden is a burden.
But lotto winners' luck doesn't stop with their fantastic win. Unlike most footballers, they then get a thorough counseling session from Gidani, designed not only to help them appreciate the need to nurture and protect their fortunes, but also to identify any problems in attitude before they lead to difficulties.
You know, as Africans, I'm not just me and my husband and my children. I'm me, my husband and my children and my aunt and my mother and my grandparents. So we want to understand how this money would be distributed, because immediately some of the people would say, well, what I'm going to do, I'm going to give $100,000 to my cousin, $50,000 to my brother, and so on. Then we say, no, let's just slow down.
Lottery winners can be encouraged to put their money into trust funds, securing it against the kind of euphoric overspending that also wrecks footballers' fortunes. They might even receive the attention of a well-being service, where counsellors visit them regularly to see what's changed in their life and warn if there are telltale signs that big money is leading them astray into drinking or gambling heavily, for instance.
As soon as we note that this person is probably not from a unified family, or they don't know what to do with the money, then we start telling them exactly that, listen, sir, madam, you have won $1 million. And with $1 million, you can actually buy so many things, maybe 10 times of this house, 10 times of that house, 10 times of that house, for them to have an understanding of where they are at in their life.
Is that a lesson that football clubs can learn from you? Because when it comes to football players, they receive their money from the clubs, and the clubs really take no interest in what the player does with his money, what happens to that player. All they care about is how he performs on the field on the day.
I think it is a good thing to do from the organizational point of view. If the football clubs can say, you're one of our best footballers and we would like you to keep as much wealth as you can, it does so many things to so many people. For the club, it says any other person would like to affiliate. And to the player, it says, I'm in good hands.
It's sometimes hard to sympathize with the problems faced by professional football stars, or indeed lottery winners, especially when some of them bring ruin on themselves through living it up and wasting their money. But not every African player is a spoiled brat. Some just find it hard to manage any kind of regular wage. Some don't know how to handle contracts and investments. Some are just naive and ill-prepared for the big bad world. Which brings us back to education. Far from South Africa, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, there's a school that just could provide the answer. It's been set up by Neil Lamptey, a man who knows better than most about the dangers of poor, uneducated youngsters going out into the footballing world. At the age of 17, Neil had that world at his feet. Hailed as his natural successor by no less a star than Brazilian legend Pele, he left home without any life skills whatsoever and went to play for the Belgian club Anderlecht. But he unwittingly allowed his earnings to go astray, and he says it was all down to his own lack of schooling.
I was going on loan and I never knew what I was doing. Apparently my manager has bought my ride from Anderlecht that I did not know. When I wanted to go back to Anderlecht, they told me that, no, I don't belong to them. Can you imagine? I've been playing for all these big clubs for nothing. Just playing for fun.
So when you were growing up, as far as you're concerned, education was not anything important. All you wanted to do was play football.
I don't know what is even education, only football. I did not know anything at all. The pain is there. Sometimes it's difficult to describe it. Or to
but I can
explain.
See tears in your eyes. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. It's okay. It's okay.
But thanks to his school, Ni's story doesn't end there. He's using his experience to ensure that at least some of tomorrow's football talent will be savvy enough to know the pitfalls and avoid them.
At the end of the day, the best gift you can give your child in this modern world is education.
Ni says no African player should ever again be sent overseas without being properly prepared for living on their own, managing their finances, and getting qualified to earn another living if it all goes wrong. His initiative is inspiring people across the continent to demand that players get more than just a paycheck in return for their goals.
We all get money. Players are not awarded education. I think it's high time that organizations and teams go that route and be in a position to help these players.
Shoes again, making the point that there are precedents for international players to take to the classroom, and they could easily pave the way to a brighter future.
I mean, football has been so cosmopolitan to the extent that you find Chinese players playing in the UK, and within a short space of time, you find that Yuxing Park speaks English. Why don't we do that even with life skills, even with finance and with management of their lives? Why don't we take them to schools or colleges, you know, and be in a position to empower yourself, not in monetary terms only?
And there is some sign that African football authorities are taking notice. A new football academy in South Africa will integrate training with life skills, psychological awareness, and of course, regular academic teaching. There's talk of the country's universities offering courses tailored to players' timetables and workshops specifically geared to improving financial literacy. But the real step change will come when more African children get more basic education. As we've heard in this series, fame doesn't last forever, and for many footballers, neither does the money. So it's clear that even the best players should focus not only on kicking a football, but on exercising their minds a little more. Saving schemes, gate levies, and of course, the coach's strict discipline can all play a part in helping the poor soccer stars. But there's really no other way of ensuring a decent retirement once the final whistle blows on their careers.